Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, October 13th, 2013. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums.
The Eureka Springs Original Ozark Folk Festival presents a live recording of Michael Jonathan's Wood Songs Old Time Radio Hour. It's Saturday, October 26th in the City Auditorium. Guests include Michael Martin Murphy and Leroy Troy and the Tennessee Mafia Jug Band. This recording will be aired on public radio and television, as well as the Armed Forces Radio Network. Tickets are available at theaud.org.
Ahead on this edition of Weekend Ozarks, an invasive rock snot algae is threatening to take over parts of the White River. Plus, the latest artist at the Fayetteville Underground is stirring the emotions of viewers with his work.
But first, last week it was stories about the federal government shutdown. And this week, Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis brings us stories related to the outdoors in his weekly review.
Trees are easily one of the more visible parts of our outdoor environment, and more trees are coming to Bentonville this month, as volunteers aim to plant 1,026 trees in the city leading up to and on National Make a Difference Day on October 26th. Troy Galloway, the city's director of planning services, says that several organizations are helping the city increase its tree canopy.
Walmart very generously contributed $25,000 as a matching grant for money that the city is providing to actually purchase the trees. So without that partnership, we would be doing about half as much in terms of planting this year. But Walmart really stepped up to the plate with a very generous cash gift. Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art really is the backbone of the volunteer effort, and they have lent a lot of professional expertise in helping lay out and identify sites for the tree plantings. Crossland Construction is going to help prepare the holes. Bentonville Public Schools is providing one of the planting sites and also providing a significant volunteer base.
Galloway says that the tree planting effort is a direct result of a study published in the last year that looked at the tree canopies of the major cities of Northwest Arkansas.
That study was an eye-opener for our community. I mean, we knew intuitively that we had lost significant canopy over the last several years of high rate of development in our community. We really didn't have any idea that it was as low as it was, sitting there at 19%. And over the coming years, we're going to do everything that we can locally here to improve that tree canopy coverage and hopefully get much closer to that 40% coverage that's an ideal target.
The trees will be planted at five areas throughout the city. In Memorial Park, along John DeShields Boulevard, along Walton Boulevard near the Walmart home office, Southwest I Street, at the former Tiger Stadium, and at Mary Mae Jones Elementary, which will receive more than 200 trees. Another clearly visible outdoor amenity is our lakes and streams, and the inherent water quality in those bodies of water. The results of the 8th annual Secchi Day at Beaver Lake were released this week. In August, 30 volunteer teams used black and white Secchi discs to measure the water clarity depth at 35 sampling sites around the lake. The teams also collected water samples, which were analyzed for nitrate, phosphorus, and chlorophyll concentrations. Dr. Robert Morgan is the manager of water quality for the Beaver Water District. He says that the data collected this year shows that average Secchi depths increase closer to Beaver Lake, which isn't really new information, but the data also shows that Secchi depths increase during drought years like 2006 and 2012, but decrease during flood years like 2008 and 2011.
What does that tell us? Well, something is coming in with the storms on those years when things are flooding. Something is different there that causes more algae, which causes less Secchi depth. And, you know, the thing we need to look for now is, what is it that's coming in? And can we make a connection and figure out how to manage that more effectively? We can also look at it, and we can see that there's a definite relationship between the amount of chlorophyll and the Secchi depth. And that basically means that what we're measuring with Secchi depth in August is the amount of algae in the lake, because the chlorophyll gets the green stuff in the algae.
Morgan says that nitrates and phosphorus, which both contribute to algal growth and higher chlorophyll concentrations, flow into the lake from the reservoir's headwaters and from other point and non-point sources. But in Beaver Lake, it's the phosphorus that acts as the limit to algal growth. However, because only 8 years of data exists, only certain things can be determined pertaining to water quality at the lake.
The main driver, as you can tell from the data, is the weather. And some years it rains a lot more than other years. So if we just look at 8 years, then all we're really looking at is weather. not a trend over time. So that's where you have to look through the drought cycles and things like that. And it's even more complicated because the climate changes over time, too. So you have to look at a real long term of data to see if it's a real trend.
But Morgan says that water itself doesn't change over time, and that if indicators of a change in water quality arise, it usually signals a change in external factors, like a different land use or new discharge into the lake. Lakes are wide open spaces, but so are fields full of crops, and winter wheat planting will start later than usual in some parts of Arkansas this year. Jason Kelly is an extension wheat and feed grain specialist for the University of Arkansas System Division of Agriculture. He says planting too early can leave growing wheat vulnerable to freeze damage or put it at risk for hungry fall armyworms and other insects and diseases.
We've started planting wheat a little bit. I would say in general we're behind compared to especially last year and probably previous years. And one of the slowdowns has been the summer crops, soybeans, rice, corn. They're maturing later this year than that what they did last year. Most of our wheat is planted behind another crops, and when those harvests get delayed, that just delays wheat planting.
Kelly says October is the crucial month for wheat planting in the state. Planting wheat earlier or later can still produce good yields, but the crop could be at greater risk for problems. And cyclists in Fayetteville will eventually face fewer risks of their own in getting to some parts of town. This week, we reported on a future bike route planned to run along North Street and through part of the VA hospital property. Matt Mihalovich is Fayetteville's City Trails Coordinator.
Ultimately, it'll be painted signs and symbols on the pavement directing people how to get through to the signal at Evelyn Hills there in front of Cross College, and then leading back toward Woolsey, toward Wilson Park and Skull Creek Trail. So we see it as an important connection through there. Currently, there's a gate closing off part of it, so we would open that gate up and install a red bollard that we use to keep cars out but allow bikes and pedestrians to come through.
Mihalovich says that the Midtown route will connect to the city's trail system to several destinations in the Midtown area.
We've had a lot of citizen requests for a better connectivity to Evelyn Hills Shopping Center with Ozark Natural Foods there and many other destinations, as well as connection to the UAMS and the VA campuses. So this is something that we've been working on. Alderman Petty has been very involved working on this. We've been working on it for probably a year, and we're getting close to getting all the loose ends tied up on the agreements and different things.
He says that though there are still a lot of formalities to go through in regards to getting required agreements from UAMS and the federally run VA, Mihalovich hopes to have the route completed sometime next year. From the Harold and Blanche Kalk News Studio, I'm Timothy Dennis, and this is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
A nuisance algae nicknamed Didymo has been documented in the White River watershed. And as Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, conservationists have launched a public campaign to make sure it doesn't spread.
Rainbow trout play tag in a shallow waterfall on Roaring River Spring Branch, southeast of Cassville, Missouri. The turquoise water is so clear it magnifies the fish and their crystalline habitat. Chilly spring-fed water rushes over gravel and rocks, pulsing with lush green algae, common in Ozark streams. But a new predator algae could be lurking in the stream bed undetected. Paul Spurgeon is manager of the Missouri Department of Conservation Trout Hatchery here at Roaring River State Park. He works in a restored 70-year-old Civilian Conservation Corps limestone complex next to a dozen spring-fed hatchery pools churning with tiny trout.
Roaring River State Park is one of four trout parks in Missouri. It's spring-fed, and the spring puts out about 20 million gallons of water a day, about 58 degrees, which creates a perfect habitat for trout fishing. This area is stocked every day with trout, and people come here to fish.
And therein lies the danger. Anglers who have fished in other places can carry algae cells on their waders and fishing gear, potentially infecting this stream with a nuisance single-cell algae, scientifically known as Didymosphenia geminata, Didymo for short, or D. geminata in the literature. Didymo thrives in cold water environments like the tailwaters beneath Bull Shoals Dam in Arkansas.
And the reason the dams are a good place for this to happen is because the water that are discharging is coming off the bottom of the lake and it's colder, so that's what creates that trout water below Table Rock and below Bull Shoals.
Didymo has been documented in 18 states, primarily in Colorado, Montana, and Washington. The organism's also infected streams in New Zealand, Europe, and Asia. Once it takes over, Didymo can dominate.
Before it blooms, it's just going to will be like a little spot on a rock. But it puts out a stalk to when it reproduces. And these stalks, it's also called rock snot because these stalks will get real sticky. And that's how it adheres to the substrate of the river. And is able, as the longer it's there, the more that these stalks will start coming out. And it's actually the stalks that do that. Eventually, it will just blanket over the whole bottom of the river, which disrupts the life cycle of a lot of macroinvertebrates, caddisflies, that kind of stuff that in the food chain. So like a wild trout population, it would severely devastate those because they would not be able to go from fry up to adulthood.
The biofilm can grow to become 8 inches thick, smothering the life out of streams. According to the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission, Didymo is now present in the White River below Beaver Dam, the Norfolk tailwaters on the North Fork of the White River, and Greer's Ferry tailwaters on the Little Red River. Paul Spurgeon says it was first detected in the United States more than 30 years ago.
It was first discovered kind of like in the mid-80s. It's naturally occurring in the northern sections of North America, and it thrives in conditions that are, it takes cold water, and it takes a pH of about 7, and the water has to be oxygen rich. And so with trout waters, the spring water is just naturally perfect because of the limestone. The karst topography is made of limestone. That brings your pH up to the correct areas. We're 58 degrees here year-round, so the cold water trout streams are at risk, whereas a regular river wouldn't be. It's too warm.
This hatchery contributes just a fraction of the White River watershed's wildlife-related economy. In both Arkansas and Missouri, $2.8 billion in revenue in 2011. And a nuisance algae like Didymo places both states at risk.
When you take an invasive species and put it where it doesn't have other things that keep it naturally, they always explode. Same thing with zebra mussels and that kind of thing when they get out of their natural habitat. So the invasive species are always worse when they get into an area that's fresh and brand new because they outcompete every other thing that's there.
Roaring River State Park Hatchery produces 500,000 trout annually, with half going to stock this river system alone. Up and down the banks, dozens of fly fishermen try their luck on the fish. But soon, they'll also see scientists sampling the stream bed.
We have plans as well. We're going to go through in the spring. We were going to do it this fall, but we had a flood, so we put it off. But we're going to go through and collect rocks just to see if those cells are out there and just haven't shown themselves. Because there's a theory that it could already be out there, it just hasn't bloomed. So we want to get a benchmark to say it's either we have it, we know it's here, or we know it's not there. So we're going to be doing that in the spring.
In the meantime, agencies and park staff have been working to educate the public on how to prevent the spread of Didymo.
What we call wader wash stations here in the park. And that has, you can walk into these with your waders, and it's got a 5% salt solution in there in a brush, and you can actually clean your waders before you go into the river, and the salt solution will kill that. The other thing that we do is what we call the check, clean, and dry, and that's when you've been to another area. When you get done, you check your equipment, make sure that there's nothing hanging on you. You dry it out. You can use a chlorine solution, just household bleach, weak solution, like 2%. You can clean that. You can clean it with dish detergent and then put it out in the sunlight. Let your equipment dry before you go move to another area.
Algae blooms are often linked to excessive nutrients in waterways, but Didymo reportedly seems to thrive in pristine waters, able to fix small amounts of phosphorus and iron. Eradicating it from aquatic environments is impossible given current science. So for now, prevention is the best measure. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Skull Sculpture is the art of carving, modeling, welding, or otherwise producing figurative or abstract works of art in three dimensions. Typically, we think of sculptures as being made from granite, bronze, plaster, or wood. But what about hot glue? This month's show at the Fayetteville Underground includes Flowers and Worms, a three-piece work by artist Robert Lemming. Robert says what a piece is made of really isn't that important, but rather what an artist is wanting to do and what material is best to accomplish that. This was a piece that he wanted to play with light.
Hot glue, in the instance of the three that I have up here, of the Flowers and Worms piece, that hot glue is very translucent. It has a memory to it. It's flexible, it's kind of alive, and it was just one of those things, like I would be doing another project and I'd have this like hot glue gun or something, I'd have this big wad of hot glue, and that's kind of a faux pas material to use. And I always, you know, and to me it's not even, it's more of a concern of what am I trying to get? And so sometimes I'll work in foam, sometimes I'll work in acrylic, sometimes I'll paint, you know, it's not really specific.
On a back wall of the underground gallery, the translucent works hang and stick out from the wall, framed by light both from behind and in front. The pieces are large and at first glance look like a flower, perhaps an iris or an orchid, with long tendrils dangling from the centers of each. The petals of the flowers are made from molds that Robert made from trace fossils he had found. He was intrigued by them and took them to the geosciences department at the University of Arkansas to identify.
They look like vegetation. That's what I thought they were. And they're called fucoid structures. And that's kind of a false name because fucoid is actually an algae. And they look very much like something you'd see on a seabed. And while they're related to the ocean, they're related to things that were crawling on the bottom of the ocean 325 million years ago. But if you were to look at it, you're looking at this basically a rock, a natural cast, and you see something that looks like a vegetable. You know, something that looks like flora or fauna. And all of a sudden, you know, realizing that it was actually bottom feeders, so it was actually much more of a kind of a visceral, different approach had made this beautiful thing that made me question it all.
He says that was what interested him. That movement could create an object. And that when you think about art, it is sometimes just a series of movements, like a brushstroke. As he originally saw something plant-like in the fossils, he knew he wanted to do something with vegetation and made two molds. One about a square foot in size, the other about 3 inches wide and a foot long.
I would make casts of them, and I'd have these drawings, and I'd just lay these casts out literally on my bed and just kind of arrange them and just trust myself to kind of find what I thought I wanted and what was actually working and then kind of devise something to make them all connect.
Robert isn't really sure how many glue sticks he used, having bought up all the local hardware stores had to offer before learning he could buy them in bulk on the internet. He says it's more about how many pounds of glue he used.
And after I made that first cast, I just tried it, just injected it with hot glue and took it out. But yeah, each one of those components, like, they're just depending on how thick they had to be structural, it was took a lot. And then all the blending areas, all the areas where they bonded or where I created, like there's tendrils, and the tendrils are things that I had to create. So there was a lot of like learning to work with it and learning to blend it in and make them all kind of join strong and look like cohesive.
Those tendrils could be a play on the worm-like creatures who created the trace fossils, or the stigma of an actual flower. He literally shot hot glue from a hot glue gun and into the molds. The amount of light that shows through depends on the thickness of the glue. He was able to pop the pieces in and out of the molds to check for holes or area that light wasn't coming through very well.
The reason there's areas where it's really dense or the color changes is sometimes because they got superheated so many times where they were bonded or because it was just so thick. The thicker it gets, the more opaque it gets. And so like I try to make like the more wispier end pieces be just a little bit thinner and just keep that, you know, kind of that lightness to it. But once you get to the base or the body, you can see that there's natural color changes that happen that were really kind of a pleasant surprise. You know, it was just kind of a result of the process. I think by the third one I'd done, I'd realized, which is the one on the far left, I'd realized what it was doing and I could kind of predict it more.
It was always an experiment, and Robert says he just wanted to see if he could do it. Numerous people had told him that working with hot glue was a bad idea, but he saw the pieces in his head and he knew he could make it work.
That's all I want to do when I create art is I think of what fascinates me and what do I want to see. So there's like this very selfish motivation initially, just like what would I like to see that nobody's doing? And then that's where I start. And then hopefully, you know, people will respond to it, which thankfully, you know, more often than not, when I go pretty far off the deep end, people seem to be receptive. I don't know why. But, you know, I think we're all fascinated by things we don't quite understand. And that's It's like I try to make a very specific thing that you can't really put your finger on, but you can. It's very detailed, and there's like that kind of push and pull that's really nice. It's something I've always kind of went for, even when I was just drawing.
He thinks about ambiguities in art. He has shown the piece before and noticed the response seemed to have a gender ambiguity. Men would approach him and see something gross or alien-like, and females would see the beauty of a flower. An unintentional psychological test on people because they want to make a connection and closure with the piece. He says the truth is, it's neither, rather something in between. A member of Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art's preparatory team, this is Robert's first show at the Fayetteville Underground, which he says is a valid opportunity for him and a good way to communicate with the community. Samantha Sigman is the gallery manager and one of the only paid employees here. Artists are chosen by a committee vote.
Yeah, well, it was an easy vote, so it was pretty simple. We passed around his some of his images, and everyone was really excited. And every time that people go around this corner, they just get so like they kind of have this little gasp because they see that, and it's really fun. And we're really taking the gallery in some interesting ways. And every month, it's going to be, I think, something new and interesting. Something that you wouldn't expect in the Underground. So
gallery shows at the Underground change month to month. Samantha says this month's show includes photography, paintings, and sculpture of other material.
The month before, we have a new artist, Jean Vacroth, who got her BFA last year as well from the university. Yeah, and so she is a kind of a fiber art sculptor. Kind of one of those kind of mixed media installation artists that I think are taking the gallery in an interesting direction. And so she's from New Orleans, and she was a Katrina refugee. And so she went to high school with me, and she actually deals pretty directly with that kind of idea. And it's got this very kind of New Orleans feel. It's dark but beautiful at the same time. Kind of like Robert's stuff is kind of grotesquely beautiful, but that's kind of what I like about it, is that in between, that kind of like, oh, this is so pretty, but oh, like that kind of thing. So that's what I like, is people really being able to go up and be like, oh, why is it like that, and really engage with what's on the wall or what's in the gallery.
Robert Lemming is the newest artist at the Fayetteville Underground. His work, Flowers and Worms, will be on view through the end of October. Samantha Sigman is gallery manager. For more information, FayettevilleUnderground.com. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
We love to celebrate history here. From the Fort Smith National Historic Site to the Shiloh Museum in Springdale, there are several places dedicated to cataloging our stories. Sunday morning, the First Presbyterian Church in Bentonville will take special note of its long history and special place in Northwest Arkansas's past and present. Heritage Sunday will include an exhaustive timeline for examination, a short video, and special music to commemorate more than 180 years of existence.
And all our churches are up there on the wall, the pictures. And that's the biggest Sunday school class they ever had up to that time. My daddy was president of that, and his picture's there.
Marilyn Hatcher says she first attended services at the First Presbyterian Church in Bentonville in 1941. The church then wasn't at its current address on Northeast J Street. The church has moved a few times, but that's to be expected for a congregation that has been connected to Bentonville and Benton County since before either was formally incorporated. Church records indicate the current First Presbyterian Church can trace its roots back to the Cumberland Presbyterians, who came to the rugged Arkansas frontier in the 1830s. It's not an exaggeration to say the church has been an influential part of the city of Bentonville since, and almost every major event in the city's history has ties to the church. When most of the buildings in the city were burned during the Civil War, so was the Presbyterian Church, according to Francis Boyd, a member of the congregation since 1950.
Our church was burned. One of the churches, I think it was the Woods community, that was burned. And then they rebuilt afterwards.
Many historical accounts suggest no fewer than a half dozen homes were left in the city after the war. By 1877, church records indicate a newer church was built on West Central Avenue. It was also after the Civil War that the Presbyterian congregation wanted to do something to restore Sunday school and expand public education opportunities in what was still a remote part of the country. Francis Boyd says the earliest roots of public school can be traced to the church and a building still located on 2nd Street.
And it was used as a Sabbath school, and then they started public school. And it has a marker in front that the people can see. And that's where school restarted here in Bentonville.
And Francis Boyd and Marilyn Hatcher say the church was also instrumental in the establishment of a public library in the city more than 70 years ago.
During the Depression, there was a young man came here to do missionary work, and he saw a need for it and started collecting books from everywhere. And Miss Anna Graves was the first librarian, and she continued for years.
She was still there when I was a little girl, and I was scared to death of her. You'd better not talk in Miss Anna's library. And she was a Sunday school teacher, too, and Linda had her, and Linda said I was so scared of her, I could hardly bring myself to go to Sunday school.
Church history also includes the launch of an early version of a school lunch program, the founding sponsorship of the Helping Hands program, as well as services still offered through the church, like the My Friends and Me child care program and a food pantry. The church roles include congregants who have left indelible marks on the town, the state, and the country. James H. Berry, who served as Arkansas's 14th governor and as a United States senator, was a member of the church, as was Neil Compton, the man often credited with spearheading the effort to save the Buffalo River, and Sam and Helen Walton. The current First Presbyterian home on Northeast J Street was built in 2000. But it has several reminders of the church history, including a bell that was part of the church for more than a century after it was delivered to Bentonville from Philadelphia in 1877 by a member of the congregation with the last name of Dinsmore.
He went up there with a team of mules and brought that and the original pulpit furniture, which we still have down here, and we used it until we moved into this church.
The church has been recording history since the first congregations gathered, and this Sunday's heritage celebration owes a debt to those early historians. But a rich history is not just the facts and dates, but also the stories of the people. Members of the church's history committees wanted those stories too. And it's hard to imagine the committee could find many people better at telling those stories than Marilyn Hatcher.
They wanted people to talk about their memories and asked me if I said, well, sure, and I just started talking. And Don would say, well, tell about this, or tell about that, or tell about Miss Sophie and her Red Thunderbird, and tell about this and that, you know. And she was a church member who always, her son was killed tragically in the war, and she always wore black, and her face was the same color as that blackboard, and, oh, she was so white, and she wore great big black picture hats, and long black elbow-length gloves, I mean everywhere. I think she probably wore them to bed. And Miss Sophie drove this huge, long black Lincoln, and she was a member of our church. And one day, this car salesman approached Miss Sophie, and Denver Matthews, and he would talk to the boys about his new cars, and he'd say, I'm telling you, boys, the floor's got fuzz on it that thick, and it's got a stolen banjo. And he got a hold of Miss Sophie and sold her a bright red porthole Thunderbird, and the whole town was just on its head. They couldn't, well, anyway, that's the kind of stories that Don would want me to tell.
Healy Eichert has been going to church at First Presbyterian in Bentonville since 1989 when she was in college, and many of her family's stories have been centered in the church since. She says those commonly occurring events are also an important part of the church's heritage.
Well, my son grew up in this church. I got married in this church. My son was baptized in this church, and I love the people. And a lot of the people that were in the church when I was in college are still here, unless they've, you know, moved, but a big majority are. So I think just the connection to the community and the connection we have as a congregation keeps people here.
And Marilyn Hatcher says for members of the church who've been in the pews longer than Healy, the connections run deep and a long way back.
Christmas was so funny because we had a Sunday, Santa Claus, and Daddy would go out and cut the biggest cedar tree he could find, and he put cedar trees up there in the front, And we had this old moth-eaten red suit with raggedy white stuff on it. But we kids just thought it was wonderful, and everybody got a present because our Sunday school teachers brought us presents. And they made them. And I still have my little crocheted Bible bookmark that I've had in that Bible ever since that I got.
First Presbyterian Church in Bentonville will celebrate its history with a special commemoration at 11:15 Sunday morning, following the worship service at 10:15. A service that connects parishioners to their congregational ancestors who were likely doing the same thing on an October Sunday more than 175 years ago.
Later today on This American Life, a homicide detective is reviewing cold cases, and he comes across a video of this interrogation he had done years before.
I'm just sitting back with my feet up on the table, the TV's up there, the tape's running, and I just had an oh my God moment. Oh my God, look at what I've done.
What he sees changes everything for him, changes his life. Later today.
This American Life just ahead this morning at 10 o'clock here on KUAF 91.3 FM.
University of Arkansas homecoming was this weekend, and the Razorbacks live mascot Tusk made his usual appearance. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda actually visited Tusk and his keepers near Dardanelle before this weekend, and she has this report.
Fayetteville may be the home of the Hogs, but the home of the main Razorback, as in the University of Arkansas's live mascot, is a farm near Dardanelle in Yale County. Tusk 4 is an approximately 300-pound Russian boar who lives on Keith Stokes Farm. Keith was raised in Arkansas, and his family has a long history with the state, as his grandfather was born here in 1880. Growing up, his family ran a poultry farm, and Keith always knew he wanted to be a farmer. When he finally got the chance, he became a hog farmer, which is how he came to be the caretaker of the university's mascot. Keith recalls that in the 90s, game attendance was low, and former athletic director Frank Broyles wanted to do something to improve the game time atmosphere. In an effort to do so, Broyles reached out to former player David Basil.
And of course, David, being a former player, said the first thing he wanted was a real, actual Razorback mascot, because when he played, what they'd do is they'd go out to the university farm and pick up a red Duroc, which is the only hog that's red. But it's not a Razorback. And bring it in, and it Duroc has large floppy ears, kind of like a bloodhound, which always gives you the perception of laziness. And David always said he looked like a lazy hog laying there, but I mean, that's just the way they looked. So I was president of the Arkansas Pork Producers Association at the time, so David contacted me and says, I need to find a authentic Razorback hog, could you help me? And he said he had contacted the New York Zoo and the San Diego Zoo, and they couldn't find them. And a real good friend of mine was director of livestock and poultry called Dr. Starkey, and I called him, and he knew a guy in Greenbrier that had two perfect ones. So we actually found them here in our backyards.
Initially, the hogs were housed at the Little Rock Zoo. After 5 or 6 years, Keith says the zoo hired a new director who wanted to go a different direction, and they needed to find a home for the one hog that was still living. At this point, the university wanted to start a breeding program. The hog was moved to a Tyson experimental station in northwest Arkansas, and the breeding program began. Tusk 1 was selected in 1997 and served as the Razorback mascot for 8 years. Tusk 2 took over for his father in 2004. Tusk 4 is the current mascot, and he entered his first full season in 2011 after debuting at the 2011 All-State Sugar Bowl. He follows his uncle, Tusk 3, who is retired, and both of the animals still reside on the Stokes farm. Keith says this is the 8th year he's had the boars on site. After closing his own hog farm, the opportunity arose for the mascots to move to the Stokes farm, where Keith could care for them every day. According to the Encyclopedia of Arkansas, Razorbacks are wild boars who earned their name because of their high, hair-covered backbone and ill-mannered temper. The true wild boar, also called the European or Russian boar, is not native to the United States. Christopher Columbus introduced their domesticated ancestors to America in 1493. Domestic swine arrived in Arkansas with the first settlers. Several escaped and bred with their wild counterparts and became what we now call wild boars. The Razorback name came to the University of Arkansas after then-football coach Hugo Bezdek said his team played like a wild band of Razorback hogs during a victory over LSU in 1909. The nickname became increasingly popular, and the student body voted to change the official university mascot from the Cardinal to the Razorbacks in 1910. To get to Tusk Four's 8,000-square-foot barn, you can ride an ATV across the Stokes land. After driving across the farm and passing through a gate, you'll come upon the mascot's heated and cooled indoor home. Parked outside is the familiar red trailer you often see him in during public appearances. The 20-year-old custom-built trailer is 20 feet by 8 feet, and while it has no official name, Keith refers to it as the Tusk Taxi. Tusk's living area can be heated or cooled depending on the weather, and it also has a camera, so Keith, as well as his wife, son, or daughter, can watch the hog while they're driving down the road. It's equipped with a public address system, which can be used while the Spirit Squad rides atop the trailer during special events. At night, Keith says they can put up a tent over the top of the trailer where he and his family can sleep, so Tusk is never left alone when he's away from the farm.
He knows when he's in that trailer, nothing bad is going to happen to him. Because, you know, and that makes the whole process much easier. He knows when he gets in that trailer, I'm going to get snacks, I'm going to get treats, I'm going to get attention, I'm going to get my belly rubbed. Let me in there. He is ready to go. But, all it takes is one person to mistreat him inside that trailer, and you're going to lose that trust. You're going to lose all that you've built up. So at all times, he's never alone. There's someone of my family with him at all times when he's in that trailer. But you just open the gate and say, come on, and he's in it. He is ready to go. He loves it. I mean, he loves it. He loves the attention. He knows, like I said, he knows all the good things are going to happen to him. He knows nothing bad is going to happen, so he is ready to go.
Tusk 4 and his uncle are kept in separate pens because Keith says males can be aggressive with one another. A typical day for Keith consists of releasing one of the hogs into their 10,000-square-foot outdoor pen before heading to work at Bibler Brothers Lumber Company. In the afternoon, he switches the boars from outdoors to indoors, feeds and cleans, and at night he locks them up. Tusk is typically fed about 5 pounds of food, which consists of corn and swine finisher. Tusk's indoor pen is comprised of concrete walls that are about 4 feet high. He looks like an overgrown puppy, pacing back and forth, looking for attention or perhaps just food. He frequently jumps up on one of the wooden doors in front of each pen and chews on it. This results in replacing the doors annually.
Come here. Come here. Get up here. Get up here. Come down here.
Says Tusk likes for people to pet him, and when you do run your hand along his hair, it's hard to say what's more surprising, that his thick black hair is so coarse, or that his ears are so soft. His uncle likes to have his belly rubbed and will roll over on his side while Keith obligingly jumps into his pen. Tusk 4 will be 4 years old in February, and Keith says he's about 20 in people years. Keith says you can judge a hog's lifespan based on his size. The bigger he is, the shorter his lifespan. During game week, Tusk will get washed and loaded into the trailer to make the 2-hour drive to Fayetteville for Friday night festivities. Following that, Keith and family will return home and rest. On game day, he and his family head north once again, and it is quite the ordeal.
I've always told people, if you've ever wondered what it's like traveling with a rock star, just take a little trip with us. It is an amazing trip. A lot of people, when they first find out, they say, well, why is the mascot at the Fayetteville at the university? And which is a good question. But actually, that was a concern when we first thought about bringing him down here. You know, wouldn't it be better for him to be up there? But actually, we get more exposure. He gets more exposure, and the university gets more exposure being down here with the travel up. We have what we call gas station pep rallies. We have a sound system on the trailer, so we can... Anytime we can pull in, hit a switch, we've got an instant pep rally. We've got a fight song playing. We got people pumped up. So we have people waiting for us at the gas station. Some people like to follow us up on game day. So it's a pretty unique experience.
Tusk can be found at football games played in Fayetteville and Little Rock, as well as any bowl games. He also makes appearances at other sporting events like basketball games, although those are less frequent because they're often scheduled for weeknights, and Keith and his wife both have full-time jobs. Tusk is definitely a fan favorite, and he can even give autographs. Keith was inspired by participants in the Burles Kids program, who often have their shirts signed by cheerleaders and players. Keith decided Tusk should be able to do the same, so they made a stamp of his right hoof. Fans' dedication to the Razorbacks is inspiring to Keith. For example, during a trip to Dallas, Keith says he was getting fuel when he was approached by a couple he could tell was moving based on their packed truck.
Oh, we got to get a picture. My grandpa was a graduate. He graduated class of 1948 or something. And if he knew we saw this and couldn't get a picture of Tusk, we'd go crazy. So I started talking to him. I said, what? He said, well, they were from Baylor. And they had just gotten a job in North Carolina, and they were relocating to North Carolina. And we're going the opposite way. North Carolina's east. We were going west. I said, guys, y'all going the wrong way. North Carolina's that way. He said, oh, no. He said, we met y'all on the interstate an hour ago. And we pulled over, and we've been following you for an hour, hoping that you would pull over. And I said, so you're going 2 hours, because it's an hour to here, and that's going to be an hour to make up that time. He said, you don't understand. He said, my grandpa would kill me if I didn't know, if I seen this and didn't get a picture. And I mean, I just couldn't believe it, that they went 2 hours out of their way just to do that. So it's little stuff like that we do it.
Keith is also in awe of the university's commitment to the program, which he says is exemplified through the Tusk Fund. In the fall of 2008, the University of Arkansas Athletics Department, in conjunction with Razorback Sports Properties, established the fund to assist in the maintenance and upkeep of the university's live mascot. Though Keith spends much of his time with one of the most recognizable mascots in the country, he is nothing but humble about his duties.
A lady at church asked me one time, she said, hey, so I want to know what it feels like pulling a stadium and have 75,000 people screaming at you. And I said, well, I don't know, because the first thing you got to remember is they're not screaming for you. I could fall off the face of the earth tomorrow. Ain't nobody know it. It's all about what's in that trailer in the back. And that's why we want it. I would love for people to say, you know what? I don't know who takes care of me, but they do a good job. And that's what I don't want. You know, it's not about us. It's not about the Stokes. We don't care if nobody knows our name, because it's not about us. It's all about him back there.
For more information on Tusk, you can visit facebook.com/tusk.mascot.
Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda filed that report for a daily edition of Ozarks at Large last week.
And she will be hosting tomorrow's daily edition of Ozarks at Large at noon.
She will. She'll be here solo.
Now, speaking of Tusk and pigs,
you had to do our Sunday morning montage,
right,
on pigs.
So the inspiration was pigs, and here we go.
One man's poison is another man's bacon.
Barbarian!
How did the pig tracks get on the ceiling?
Spider pig, does whatever a spider pig does. Can he swing from a web? No, he can't. He's a pig. Look out!
Thank you.
single human in the stands or in the commentary boxes was at a complete loss for words. The man who in his life had uttered fewer words than any of them knew exactly what to say.
That'll do, Pig. That'll do.
To see if you could identify the 10 clips in our pig montage this morning, just go to our website, ozarksatlarge.com.
And I'm going
to
offer this quick apology to our colleague Antoinette Grajeda, because I did not put in that warthog from The Lion King, and she'll think that no montage about pigs is complete without it.
But it's a warthog.
Thank you.
All right.
Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. It's the 13th of October, 2013. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I'm about to babble about something about which I know nothing.
All right.
It should be fun.
Yes.
I know that Wakarusa happens in June.
On Mulberry Mountain.
I know that Thunder on the Mountain happens right after that.
On Mulberry Mountain.
And I know that, last but not least, is Yonder Mountain String Band's Harvest Music Festival.
On Mulberry Mountain.
I don't know anything about music. I keep telling you all that. But I know that Kevin Kinder, our What's Up Music writer, says that, and I'm going to read, a prime example of the rising talent level manifests itself in the stage schedule because the band's four-year partnership with Yonder Mountain String Band and the festival, they're stepping aside for some bands.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of interesting. There's some big ticket acts like Tedeschi Trucks Band.
Yeah.
And they will step aside on Thursday night for some of the other acts, and then Friday night for Tedeschi Trucks Band. And I have no idea who these people are, except it's Derek Trucks of Allman Brothers Band fame and Susan Tedeschi.
Yes.
Who is the vocalist and his wife.
Yeah, and they've had stellar careers on their own. And they also have this touring band.
So here's the main stage schedule. Starting at 2 o'clock on Thursday, The Deadly Gentlemen. 3:30, Daryl Scott and Tim O'Brien. 5:15, Green Sky Bluegrass.
If anyone saw Daryl Scott when he was here for the Roots Festival, they know it's worth the time.
Okay.
He's fantastic, as is Tim O'Brien.
7 o'clock, Casey Musgraves,
mm-hmm.
who I know that Kevin said is an up-and-comer. 8:30, J.J. Gray and Mofro. And 10:30, Les Claypool's Duo de Twang.
Very highly anticipated by many people going to the festival.
On Friday, 12:30, music starts with Useful Jenkins. 2 o'clock, Dirtfoot. 3:45, Justin Towns Earl.
Mm-hmm.
5:30, Turnpike Troubadours. 7:30, Yonder Mountain String Band. And 10 o'clock, Tedeschi Trucks Band. Saturday, 12:30, Mountain Sprout. I love them.
Mm-hmm.
I know that name. 1:45, Elephant Revival.
Who just were at Roots Festival this year.
3 o'clock, Steep Canyon Rangers. One assumes without Steve Martin.
They will be without Steve Martin, but they've got a pretty good new CD out.
4:30, Sister Sparrow and the Dirty Birds. 6 o'clock, Beats Antique. 7:45, Railroad Earth. I recognize a lot of these names.
See?
And 9:45, Yonder Mountain String Band. 3-day passes start at $160. 2-day passes, $105. 3-day VIP passes, which include food and beverages, $405. Find out more at harvestfestival.com, and if you want to keep up to the minute on festival coverage, visit Kevin's live music blog at nwatunedin.com.
It is a festival, so while you gave the main stage schedule, keep in mind there are three other stages that are going before and after the main stage as well.
And if you follow Kevin on his blog, he knows exactly what the heck he's talking about.
Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Yes, the music will be flowing come next weekend on Mulberry Mountain. One group Becca didn't mention is Roscoe Bandana. The seven-member group will perform at the festival Friday afternoon. Earlier this year, they stopped by the Carver Center for Public Radio and played this song.
Out of dim machines right off the highway. I know
baby, it's Drown-a-me-a-yo. Baby, it's girl, I'm a looking too. I'm a looking too.
I'm a looking too.
I'm a looking too. I'm a looking
That was the band Roscoe Bandana inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio at KUAF, the song Black Ole Water. They'll perform Friday afternoon at 4:30 on the Mother's Brewing Company Backwood Stage during next weekend's Yonder String Mountains Harvest Music Festival.
I think you got it.
I think so.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Bentonville, Fort Smith, and Healing Springs.
Healing Springs up toward the
Airport.
XNA.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep. I drove there on Thursday, I guess, and passed through Healing Springs. So.
There you go. So do you feel better?
Yes.
Excellent.
For sure.
Excellent.
I should say that KUAF's on-air fundraiser begins October 24th, which happens to be my mother's birthday.
Happy birthday.
And all pledges received during the month of October count toward that goal. Go to supportkuaf.com and make your pledge today. Your pledge helps keep insightful and thought-provoking programming, like Ozarks at Large, on the air. And we thank you.
Whenever you're watching a movie and your birthday is mentioned as a date, do you kind of like get a little small little jolt of excitement?
Oh, for sure.
Oh, they said May 20th. That's cool.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. All right.
Oh,
I thought
definitely.
I was the only one. That's kind of fun.
And
I mean, there's a one in 365 chance that they're going to do it, but if they say a date, I digress.
All right.
4,000 miles from Theater Squared, last day. If you haven't seen it yet, you have this afternoon and tonight.
Right. And I saw it last weekend. I really enjoyed it.
I have yet to see it.
I thought you did.
I have a couple times made plans, but then I couldn't get there.
Oh. Well,
which
you
is a sign that
afternoon.
You're too busy. I know. I don't know because of airport and other responsibilities, my goal is to get there.
Okay.
I really want to see
it. Well,
I
think you should. It's funny. Okay. The actor and the actress that are kind of the main people, they do a great job.
Yeah, and Antoinette saw it earlier this week, and she said it was well worth going to, so... I
Definitely.
Do want to see it, but it's this afternoon, tonight, and then the run is over.
Mm-hmm.
Next up for them will be Christmas Carol.
Right.
All right.
Holiday spirit.
Exactly.
Okay. Should say that Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
As we mentioned earlier, Antoinette Grajeda will be back tomorrow for an all-new daily edition of Ozarks at Large.
You and I back together, I think, on Thursday.
Right.